The political crisis deepens in Peru, where the legislative body has rejected President Dina Boluarte's bid to move elections to this year. Congress shelved the bill due to objections raised in a meeting of the Constitutional Committee on Friday. The matter is unlikely to be discussed before July, when Congress begins its new session. Lawmakers had previously agreed to move the date of the elections from 2026 to April 2024, but it could not calm the protesters. Boluarte thinks the reschedule of the voting to this year might help mitigate unrest and chaos. The South American country has been in the grip of unrest since early December. There have been frequent clashes between protesters and police in several cities, almost on a daily basis. Confrontations have resulted in dozens of deaths. Apart from early elections, Peruvian protesters also demand President Boluarte step down.
We are outraged by the injustice that is happening, by the police repression, by the deaths, by the lack of justice, also because the people are demanding the resignation of the president.
However, Boluarte has defied the calls, accusing those demanding her resignation of pursuing political blackmail.
My resignation is not at stake in this situation. There is a minority of the population, of these groups that are generating violence and chaos in the country, who are pushing for my resignation in a blackmailing manner. And we are not going to give in to this political blackmail.
The protests have also taken a heavy toll on the country's economy, with workers being hit hard. The unrest has negatively affected the export of goods and the operation at key mines, which are major sources of income for the Andean nation. The protesters around the country have blocked highways, causing shortages of food, fuel, and other essentials in several regions. Hundreds of trucks remain stranded at the border with Bolivia, awaiting the end of a strike called by the protesters.
We are suffering every day. There's nothing to eat. Look how the roads are. You can't even walk. No motorcycle, no car, nothing. Dina Boluarte's government do not pay attention to what the people are demanding. What more do they want? How many more deaths?
Peru's unrest has been propelled mainly by indigenous people from the south. That's where ousted President Pedro Castillo comes from. He was removed from office and arrested in early December as he was attempting to shutter Congress to stave off his impeachment. The demonstrators demand his release because they regard Castillo as the one who can fight poverty and inequality. It seems that the fundamental problems driving the unrest will not go away, as the protesters are not only angry over stark inequality, but they feel neglected by state institutions, especially Congress, which many Peruvians say are being run by corrupt lobbies and vested interests.
The recent decision by the European Central Bank to raise interest rates by a further 0.5% has thrown Italian families and small and medium entrepreneurs into the depths of gloom. Prices in Italy rose 8.1% year-on-year in 2022, hitting a 37-year high. Now, Italians see themselves stuck between a rock and a hard place. The country's inflation rate had shot up to around 12% in the months between October and December, a trend also seen across Europe. This is due to soaring energy and food prices linked primarily to the conflict in Ukraine and the related rearmament spending that all members of the bloc are engaged in. But it's also caused by the governments having thrown support packages worth hundreds of billions of euros at the corporations and the rich over the past years.
High inflation, soaring energy bills are biting hard. In addition to that, our average salaries have not kept up pace, and they have not gone up for years. It's really worrying.
Quite simply, I went to buy food at the supermarket last week, and the items I usually buy for 30 euros cost me about 50 euros instead.
Although inflation rates have recorded a clear abatement across Europe, Italy is still dealing with two-digit inflation, which stands at over 10%. The European Central Bank's latest rate hike has brought to 3% the total of interest rate increases over the past 6 months. The EU's governing council is expected to raise them further next month.
These moves by the ECB adopted to slow inflation don't seem to have worked very much so far. The problems affecting our economy seem to be rather structural, and this situation has led citizens and businesses to lose confidence in a real recovery.
According to a survey of some 27,000 citizens commissioned by the European Parliament, more than 9 out of 10 of Europeans are very concerned about the rising cost of living. 40% of the people living in the EU feel they are already struggling to pay for food and other basics, and almost 1 in 2 says the standard of living has fallen. But more worryingly, they are not holding out much hope for the future, either, as another 39% expect the standard of living to fall this year. Max Civili, Rome.
The 53rd exhibition of Iran's nuclear industry achievements was inaugurated in Tehran on Thursday. The event showcases the latest nuclear products made in Iran. Attended by head of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, Mohammad Islami, the expo put on display different applications of the nuclear sector, from centrifuges to radiopharmaceuticals and particle accelerators.
Despite all external pressures, we have managed to advance our nuclear sector, and this expo shows a small part of it. Today, we have become self-sufficient in nuclear fuel, radiomedicine, and many other fields such as heavy water.
In recent years, Iran has been trying to diversify the applications of its nuclear sector. Besides power generation, the country is now focusing on particle accelerators for food irradiation and radiotherapy.
Irradiation systems are being built in Iran on a national scale. This will allow the country to irradiate all its food and agricultural products. This way, we can reduce food waste, ensure food security for our people, and enhance our agricultural exports.
Since Iran indigenized its nuclear industry in 2006, it has constantly been targeted by sanctions over what the West calls fears of a nuclear bomb, something which Tehran categorically rejects, saying its nuclear program is civilian and peaceful.
As you know, the West has long been leading a psychological campaign against Iran's nuclear activity, accusing Iran of pursuing non-peaceful purposes. So we hold this exhibition for our people to see for themselves that our nuclear program is peaceful.
Following the U.S. withdrawal from the 2015 deal and reinstatement of sanctions against Tehran in 2018, Iran took retaliatory steps by scaling back its commitments to the pact. The Vienna discussions between Iran and the remaining parties to the 2015 deal, which aimed to revive the accord, have remained stalled since August last year. This, as Tehran says, it will come back to full compliance only if Washington removes all its sanctions.
By displaying these nuclear products, Iran tries to show the West that sanctions cannot disrupt its nuclear program. At the same time, the AEOI says it will continue to build up the country's nuclear industry even beyond the JCPOA limits, if sanctions are not removed. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Black Lives Matter. This is a popular slogan we often come across in the streets of the United States following the fatal shooting and beating to death of African Americans there. That began with the racially motivated killing of Breonna Taylor and George Floyd, among others. Anger and shock once again prevail as American protesters march their cities to denounce police brutalities and demand justice for another victim, 29-year-old Tyre Nichols. The man was beaten to death by a group of officers in the city of Memphis, Tennessee, after he was stopped for a traffic violation in early January. Nichols was in confusion as to why he had been stopped, but before he could know, the cops started kicking, punching, and pepper spraying him while he was crying for help. Nichols was pronounced dead in a hospital 3 days later. Activists are still in disbelief on how the police could treat a member of the society like Nichols as an enemy in the battlefield.
Here I am now in 2023, and I'm looking at another video, this in color, where I'm seeing another black man being beat to death. Rodney didn't die. This is worse. It's beat to death with no mercy on no crime that they can even find that he had committed.
Here at Nichols' funeral, his family desperately called for an end to police brutality against the African-American community. U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris, who was also present at the funeral, slammed the killing and talked about an act that has a slim chance of getting passed in the Congress. Ironically, U.S. officials have turned up on such occasions in the past and made similar promises, but to no avail. Figures show that police brutality remained as rampant as it had been in the previous years. Law enforcement killed nearly 1,200 people, or about 100 people a month last year, making it the deadliest for police violence. Repeated shooting and lack of transparency have already terrorized America's black community. Many believe the reoccurrence of the brutal scene cannot be prevented by just suspending culprits. No African American will truly become safe from police brutality until its root causes are identified and dealt with.
The most prestigious cinematic event in Iran has kicked off once again, bringing together filmmakers, directors, and members of the cast and crew, as well as movie lovers and moviegoers in Tehran. The 41st edition of the Fajr Film Festival opened with the screening of the movie Maestro by Imad Hosseini, an adaptation of Olina by David Mamet. A clear sign that this year we should be expecting a very different film festival. First and foremost is the conspicuous presence of first-time directors.
24 movies will be competing in the main categories. These movies were picked out of 87 movies that were submitted to the Secretariat. All the 24 movies will be screened first in Tehran and in about a week in 30 provinces across the country. The screenings will continue until February 12th.
But that is not all. In the international section, nearly two dozen movies are also taking part. For many of them, this is a regional movie premiere, which is why, as always, the spotlight is on the festival and movies participating in it.
The first days of the festival can tell you a lot about what's going to happen, and by the looks of things, I'm personally expecting to watch some really great movies this year.
Movies will be competing for the top award or the Crystal Seymour in six different sections based on their stories. The Cinema of Salvation, Resistance, Muhammad Amin, and Eastern Vista being the most competitive sections, with all eyes watching to see which movies will take home the Crystal Seymour.
For movie lovers and moviegoers, this is the time to be in Tehran. However, in less than a week, on February the 5th, movie theaters across the country will also be joining in. Gisumisha Ahmadi, Tehran.
The situation for refugees in and around the European Union is getting worse by the day. At a meeting of EU lawmakers in Brussels on Wednesday, it was announced tougher controls will be used on the border between EU member Bulgaria and non-member Turkey.
Like drones and radar and other means of surveillance. As we've done last year, for example, in the last years, for example, in Romania, we've done it in Spain and Greece and in Poland.
EU institutions and leaders are accused of breaking international law surrounding the protection of refugees.
What is the EU answer to these protection gaps? More walls, more drones, more returns, more funding to Libyan detention centres.
Campaigners say shunned refugees are fleeing countries destabilised by the West. At the same time, millions of Ukrainians are being welcomed here and given the same rights as EU citizens.
This is a clear, hypocritic, racist, organized policy that the EU practicing. And this is not a new thing. This is an historical discrimination that the EU stands for as an imperialist power in the world.
Legislators are calling on EU leaders to provide safe, legal routes for refugees.
We need to guarantee the right to asylum for those who need shelter so they are not shamefully piled up in refugee camps or illegally pushed back or drowned in the Mediterranean Sea.
The EU is currently developing a new asylum policy, but it's already shrouded in scepticism.
The Commission has to step up to break the cycle of mistrust existing between member states by enforcing also current rules.
Many EU nations are now struggling to accommodate the millions of Ukrainian refugees who have travelled here. Thousands more continue to arrive each day. Agencies across the EU that are already overwhelmed
warn breaking point is being reached. They are demanding additional resources from governments. Jerome Hughes at the European Parliament, Brussels.
The 44th anniversary of the late Imam Khomeini's return to Iran from several years of exile, marking the beginning of 10 days of celebrations. In Iran, festivities have begun, with Iranians from all walks of life gathering in the mausoleum of Imam Khomeini to renew their pledge of allegiance to the late founder of the Islamic Revolution, while a special ceremony is also underway, demonstrating that the divide-and-rule policy of the enemies of the Islamic Revolution has failed.
I've come here to renew my pledge of allegiance with Imam Khomeini, who was an advocate of social justice and at the forefront of fighting oppressors worldwide.
Assyrians have been living in Iran for more than 3,000 years. This shows that no matter what our enemies do, we will remain united as a nation.
Over the past 44 years, we have managed to overcome many obstacles simply because we remain united, and it's important for our nation to remain that way.
A point that was also raised by the keynote speaker of the ceremony, Parliament Speaker Mohammad Baqir Ghalibaf.
The Islamic Revolution is known worldwide with the name of Imam Khomeini, a great man known for fighting imperialism who always invited the nation to be united in the face of our enemies' plots and said, you know, you're walking down the right path when your enemies do everything they can to stop you. If your enemies are ever indifferent, it is a clear sign that we have deviated from the right path. So their increased animosity is actually a good sign.
That is why the presence of masses at the mausoleum this year is more significant than previous years, considering a period of foreign-backed riots in the country and Western countries increasing political pressure on Iran to unprecedented levels.
We are here to say that we are proud of our revolution and our country.
When Imam Khomeini needed our support to topple the Pahlavi regime, my sons did not hesitate.
I am here to say that I will always support the leader and the Islamic revolution.
My son gave his life for this revolution, and I am here to uphold his values.
Iranians are celebrating the 44th anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution at a time when they've managed to thwart foreign-backed riots in the country and bring peace and calm back to all the cities across Iran. More than anything, the 44th anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution is a show of solidarity. Gisumish Ahmadi, Tehran.
The decision to send German and American tanks to Ukraine is continuing to generate controversy. Many believe the move will prolong the war, and there's concern as to how Russia might respond. However, at a parliamentary hearing on Tuesday, EU legislators were told the West should go even further.
Russia is attacking Ukraine from Russian territory, so obviously we should provide the Ukrainians with long-range missiles, obviously.
There are a lot of EU lawmakers who agree.
Any delay to supply Ukraine with needed weaponry and ammunition is more lives lost on the battlefield.
Some argue constantly supplying lethal weapons to Ukraine is foolish.
We're prepared to risk nuclear war in order to continue this US-NATO proxy war. It is total madness. And this European Union and the European Parliament have lost the plot. They've lost the run of themselves.
European Union taxpayers have provided 50 billion euro to Kiev since last March.
What happens to all the money we send to Ukraine? Is it just disappearing into individuals' pockets? Even President Zelensky has had to admit there's a big problem with widespread corruption.
A number of legislators would like to see less division within the EU.
Austria and Hungary just decided we will not deliver weapons. Okay, it's their decision. But that shows already some hesitation or some breakup of unity.
Spanish MEP Javier Nart told his colleagues it's, quote, ridiculous to suggest Ukraine can win the war against Russia. For now, the US and Germany have ruled out providing fighter jets to Ukraine. Others, including France, have not. According to many analysts, the risk that the conflict could escalate further and spiral completely out of control has never been greater. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
In the limelight.
Russian officials say the strengthening of Ukraine's missile power by the United States will not change the war equations and will only prolong the crisis. They say the delivery of new missile launchers and long-range missiles by Washington to Kiev has not changed the reality of the war on the ground and will only prolong the conflict that was created in the first place by NATO and the West. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. The Defense News website has covered this story and tells us more. The Pentagon has announced that the United States will allow Ukraine to fire long-range missiles sent to the country at Kiev's discretion. The Pentagon said on Friday, 3rd of February, it is up to the government in Kiev to decide how to use new rockets being delivered for the U.S.-supplied HIMARS launchers. Pentagon's statement is a confirmation that the latest batch of munitions sent by the U.S. military to Ukraine to fight Russia will include ground-launched small-diameter bomb rockets. The Boeing-manufactured GLSDB, or ground-launched small-diameter bomb rockets, consist of a rocket motor mated with an airplane bomb, with an estimated range of up to 150 kilometers. Friday's announcement listed additional munitions for the HIMARS and precision-guided rockets, confirming the information leaked to Reuters news agency recently. Brigadier General Patrick Ryder told reporters that this indeed included the ground-launched small-diameter bomb rockets. Brigadier General Ryder also pointed out that the U.S. would not stand in the way of Ukrainians using the missiles to strike deep into Russia. He said on Friday, when it comes to Ukrainian plans on operations, clearly that is their decision. They are in the lead for those, he added. So I'm not going to talk about or speculate about potential future operations. But again, all along, we've been working with them to provide them with capabilities that will enable them to be effective on the battlefield. Meanwhile, the Reuters news agency claimed to have seen a Boeing document saying the first deliveries of the new munitions could be as early as spring of 2023. Bloomberg news agency cited unnamed government sources as saying the timeline for munitions delivery could be as long as 9 months, depending on when the U.S. Air Force issues the contract. Kiev has repeatedly requested the West to supply its forces with the MGM-140 Army Tactical Missile System rockets, which have a range of some 300 kilometers. Till now, the Ukrainian forces have used the HIMARS launchers supplied by the West to strike both military and civilian targets. The U.S. and its allies have not directly taken part in the hostilities, but continue to send weaponry and ammunition to Kiev, amounting to over $32 billion, since Russia launched its special operation almost a year ago. Moscow has warned the West against flooding Ukraine with arms and munitions, asserting such a move will not stop Russia from reaching its objectives and would merely prolong the conflict and add to the casualties and destruction. The website of Business Insider has also covered this story and tells us more. Russia has warned if the United States supplies Ukraine with longer-range missiles, Washington will cross a red line and become a party to the conflict, nearly 1 year into Moscow's military operation in the ex-Soviet Republic. In a recent press conference, the Russian Foreign Ministry spokeswoman Maria Zakharova said Russia reserves the right to defend its territory. She warned if Washington decided to supply longer-range missiles to Kiev, then it will be crossing a red line and will become a direct party to the conflict. The United States has already provided Kiev with advanced rockets capable of hitting targets up to 80 kilometers away, while so far refusing to publicly announce it would send rockets with more than double that range. Since the beginning of the war, the U.S. has been providing Kiev with military aid, including at least 16 HIMARS systems, four of which arrived back in August. HIMARS is a light multiple rocket launcher that can hit targets with precision. It is capable of launching all rockets specified in the multiple launch rocket system family of munitions. Its manufacturer, Lockheed Martin, says the system has a recognized and proven range of up to 300 kilometers. While Kiev is imploring for more Western weapons, Moscow says it sent troops to prevent Ukraine being used as a platform for Western aggression and to defend Russian speakers in the Donbas region of eastern Ukraine. Russian President Vladimir Putin has time and again said the U.S. is prolonging the war in Ukraine as part of what he called Washington's efforts to maintain its global hegemony. Russia's Itatass news agency has also covered this story and tells us more. A senior Russian foreign ministry official has warned Western countries that supplying long-range and more advanced weaponry to Ukraine would cross Russia's red lines, and in that case, they have to be ready for a response. Director of the Russian Foreign Ministry's second CIS department, Alexei Polishchuk, said recently, "As for the red lines, we have already designated them. First of all, these are the deliveries of long-range or more powerful weapons to Kiev. Specific measures of response to the actions by the United States and its allies, supply weapons to the Kiev regime will be defined following a thorough analysis of the developing situation." The high-ranking Russian diplomat said Russia has sufficient tools to implement them. Recently, the U.S. State Department announced that the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden has repeatedly stated that it has no intention of taking direct part in the conflict between Ukraine and Russia. It claimed, "As long as the United States or our allies are not attacked, we're not going to get directly engaged in this conflict, either by putting American troops to fight in Ukraine or attacking Russian forces." The United States is worried that the targeting Russia's territory and crossing Moscow's red line will lead to the escalation of the war and draw Washington into a direct conflict with the Russian President Vladimir Putin. Meanwhile, another senior Russian official has warned the supply of more advanced weaponry to Ukraine will just add fuel to the fire, culminating in more retaliatory strikes by Russian forces. The deputy chairman of the Russian Security Council, Dmitry Medvedev, who is also the country's former president, told journalist Nadana Friedrichsen in a written interview published on Saturday, 4th of February, that in case Ukraine receives new weaponry, all regions remaining under its rule will also burn. Dmitry Medvedev said more aid to Ukraine would mean more retaliation. Journalist Nadana Friedrichsen asked Medvedev whether the use of longer-range weapons might force Russia to negotiate with Kiev. Medvedev insisted that the use of longer-range weapons by Ukraine and its allies will not force Russia to hold negotiations. Dmitry Medvedev said the result will be just the opposite. He emphasized that Russia is ready to use all types of weapons in accordance with its doctrinal documents.
your option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The International Atomic Energy Agency has made an announcement that is void of the truth. It's issued a report that accuses Iran of making an undeclared change at the Fordo nuclear power plant. Iran made an objection and clarified the issue with the IAEA, which the agency admitted it had made a mistake. In this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at how the IAEA has once again not only politicized Iran's civilian nuclear file, but has now resorted to making false allegations against the Islamic Republic's civilian nuclear program. Let me introduce Sayed Mohsen Abbas, who's a journalist and political commentator, joining us from London. Sayed Mohsen Abbas, welcome. So we're taking a look at this accusation in which, based on the IAEA, Iran had made an undeclared change to the interconnection, as it called, between the two clusters of advanced machines enriching uranium up to 60% purity at its Fordo plant. Iran has had a reaction to that, of which it said that the IAEA inspector's interpretation was incorrect, and then immediately, obviously, informed the IAEA on this. Why is the IAEA portraying this? First of all, why would the IAEA make a mistake? These are supposed to be professionals in this most sensitive of all fields.
Well, it's right to have a little laugh at these institutions, because they really have become a total joke and completely unprofessional. I mean, look, first of all, let's get the first fact on the table. In November 22, Iran actually sent a letter to the IAEA about the decision to do this 60% enrichment. Now, the JCPOA and all the other agreements are really pretty much null and void at the moment. There's no real reason that Iran should even be abiding by anything within that agreement. But even whether it's the non-proliferation treaty or the nuclear non-proliferation treaty that they're whinging about, the truth is Iran has no obligation to do anything on any of these issues. It's their magnanimity that they actually allow the IAEA to come in and essentially spy for their paymasters. Because look, the reality is that these institutions, and let's come directly to the IAEA itself in answer to part of your question. Rafael Grossi and the like, their pay salaries ultimately come from the kind of sources which are all aligned to the Zionist interests. Inside their establishments, they have the United States of America's, various officers all installed in there, probably Zionist ones as well, Israeli ones covertly. So they are completely compromised. These institutions essentially are an instrument of what one analyst has described as pre-aggression. What their purpose is to basically create scenarios which indict Iran, and then basically come up with false charges based on the scenarios they create. And then when they can't prove those scenarios, already they've put it out to the media. So there's an environment of Iranophobia which they've developed, and they want to use those false charges then to create aggression, to create conflict, to create war, and a mood music within their own Western environments to justify potential unilateral action by the U.S. and Israel against Iran.
Isn't that just another form of lying? I mean, really, if you want to take a look at it in a simpler term. Anyways, what's more interesting here, and I'd like to get your train of thought, is the way that this was reported in the news. where it says, by a report seen by Reuters, IAEA Chief Grossi is concerned that Iran has implemented a substantial change. Then, and it came in drips. IAEA report seen by Reuters, IAEA informed Iran that its failure to declare the change was inconsistent with Iran's obligations under Article 45. And then the way the wires work, they come in with these drips, say Mohsen Abbas, maybe you're familiar, and then they issue a final report of which they say the UN nuclear watchdog chided Iran in a confidential report seen by Reuters for making an undeclared change to the interconnection between the two cascades, et cetera, et cetera. First of all, maybe you can tell us, why is it that the IAEA reports that are confidential are being overlooked by a media agency by the name of Reuters, and then for it to be broadcast, of which Iran has said, what's going on here? Why are we getting leaks like that?
Well, very simply, put simply, the Reuters themselves, if you look at the history of Reuters, you'll see that they are a complete Zionist operation themselves. They have corporate Zionist masters and owners. They are run for the purposes of creating psychological operations, media propaganda, fake news, all geared towards supporting the Zionist Western Empire and their imperialist interests. The IAEA, therefore, are working essentially in tandem with another arm of that Zionist network. This is an intricate network which clearly has infiltrated virtually every major world institution, whether it's the WHO, whether it's the World Health Organization or the United Nations or the International Atomic Agency here or whoever else overlooks the interests economically of the world. What you see is essentially a very carefully laid out set of, institutions which work for the same interests. And this is the thing that one has to understand. And that interest, the money mafia interest, the Zionist-led money mafia interest, its number one enemy is, of course, the Islamic Republic of Iran, because everything that Iran stands for, whether it's sovereignty, independence, its Vilayat-e-Faqih political system, its desire to be, on its own feet, and its progress, its advancement, its rapid advancement in the science and technological fields and all others, all of this poses a challenge to the illusions and the veneer of actual systemic, goodness that they like to usually place in the camp of the Zionist imperialist kind of institution. The fact is that those are all being exposed by Iran, and the IAEA, the JCPOA, the nuclear issue is a major revealer of these realities. So what you've got is a synchronization. These things are discussed in the corridors of power, where the Israeli lobbies will be present, and they'll pressure and push a particular line. The state operators, the politicos, the media, and of course these other institutions, then will be all clicked, simultaneously to do their particular job as and when required. And that's what you're seeing. It's all very synchronized.
Well, you talked about the Zionist regime. Of course, I'd like to find out from you what are we looking at when it comes to their participation, which they are very active, either in front of the camera through its very animated Prime Minister Netanyahu, or behind the scenes. Of course, the most recent being the visit by Israel Prime Minister to France. Interesting that France would issue anything against Iran on a civilian nuclear program in the presence of Israel when it helped Israel to develop his nuclear warhead program.
Well, this idea of helping is a very important one, because it goes well beyond helping. They establish and root all of the kind of instability in the west of Asia, particularly through Israel. Israel is their primary frontline mechanism for creating division, creating disunity amongst the Arabs, for also threatening them with military punishment and other kinds of punishment. Israel is essentially the landing base for the Anglo-Zionist empire in West Asia, and it's the chief nest of conflict creation. And in this instance, what you're seeing is Israel, being exposed again, actually, because, it's an open secret that the Israelis have well over 400 or so Iranian nuclear arms, fully tooled up. I mean, and yet what we've got is an IAEA and America and the Atlantic powers focusing on an Iran that doesn't have nuclear capability as yet, and has said that it doesn't want it either, for that matter, and has gone into negotiations to try and create a situation where everybody can be satisfied, yet that's all been rejected. And yet there is Israel, sitting right in that same region, the most nasty, the most brutal, the most torturing, undemocratic nation in that region. And that's saying something, given you've got Saudi Arabia and other despots in that region as well. There you have this particular entity, which is allowed to continue building this nuclear stockpile, and it is not subject to the non-proliferation treaty, the nuclear non-proliferation treaty at all. The IAEA makes no inspections of Israel and its kind of nuclear facilities. It doesn't even have the right to do those. And the US and the British and the French and the Germans make absolutely no noise whatsoever. But here are those same powers in Iran's situation. They've been squealing, basically saying that Iran is inconsistent with its obligations under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. Inconsistent? What about Israel? I mean, and what about, for instance, Saudi Arabia, which the Americans have literally tendered American nuclear production companies, corporates, to come in and tender for contracts to help Saudi Arabia to become nuclear developed. I mean, the hypocrisy is profound. And of course, it's all based on the fact that Israel sees Iran as its primary enemy in West Asia and its primary, opposition to Israel's own Odin Yinon plan, which is designed to basically dominate the whole of the west of Asia from the river to the sea, as they say, from the Euphrates to the Israeli, to the Mediterranean.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, it does sound like a broken record, but it really needs to always be brought into the conversation. So let's bring in John Bosnich, journalist and political analyst from Belgrade. John Bosnich, welcome. You know, the Israeli factor in Iran's civilian nuclear file has always been a thorn in the side of whatever blank you want to fill in. It's quite incredible because Israel is not a member of the NPT, but at the same time is receiving a cordial welcome when it comes to the IAEA, where Iran is a member, and yet, as our guests there just indicated, the last statement coming from U.S. and the E3 is the fact that Iran is inconsistent, along with the language that IAEA has used. Why is it that a non-NPT member can have such influence on an NPT member and be received warmly by its aides or its allies?
Well, first of all, we have to categorize which non-member that is, and that's Israel. Israel holds itself out as an exceptional state, just as America does, the exceptional superpower. And therefore, both countries, which are allies to the deepest possible level, Israeli investments elect the president of the United States in most of the elections. So what we have here is a situation where two countries, which are actually self-declared outlaw states, which do not recognize these international tribunals, which do not recognize international bodies, have by themselves created an echo chamber in which one confirms the other and the rest of the world listens because they dominate the international media. So we're being fed an illusion here by parties which themselves have not only rejected these treaties and these rules, but which have flagrantly violated them. Israel is a nuclear superpower, not just a nuclear power. In its regional area, Israel is a nuclear superpower, and it is now threatening Iran and using its leverage in the United States to pressure Iran and to actually threaten war on Iran for what Iran has opened to public inspection via the organizations of the IAEA, which is, among other international organizations, infiltrated from the top to the bottom by representatives of, guess who? Israel and the United States. It's a closed chamber in which they want to dominate all power.
Some ask, why does Iran need a civilian nuclear program, John Busnich? Based on what statements were given by the head of the Atomic Energy Organization, Mohammad Islami, one of them is that he said just recently that Iran intends to generate 20% of its electricity via nuclear energy. That on the one hand. And just today in our news, we had he officially announced the production line of sanitary, superabsorbent, blood-clotting power and the essence microwave extractor. These are all medicinal uses of nuclear energy, and basically the civilian aspect that Iran is using to the fullest. This is something that is somewhat overlooked, especially for people who ask why Iran needs a nuclear energy program with civilian purposes. Why then would there be such pushback from the U.S. and from, of course, Israel and other, again, allies?
First of all, we have to put this all in context. The entire world is talking about global warming. Iran is a major petroleum product producer, and Iran is looking at a short-term elimination of its major revenue, which is from petroleum products. My own home country, Canada, has had a nuclear program since the 1960s. We have nuclear plants across the country. There is a nuclear power plant less than 1 hour's drive from my hometown. Nobody asked Canada what we were going to do with our nuclear power plants. Nobody asked us what was the rationale for us as one of the world's leading petroleum product producers out of our Western oil fields, why we needed nuclear power. And so if we put this thing in context, why is it that Iran is asked to justify every action that it takes, which is simply a follow-on and identical to actions which have been taken by dozens of countries across the Western world? The difference, Iran is not an American colony, and we, the others, are. That's the difference. And if you were an occupied American colony, they would be pushing your nuclear power program. They would actually be suggesting to you that you get involved in their nuclear weapons research program as well. That's the way this world is run. It is not fair, and you are on the receiving end of the American empire and its Israel partners.
Mm-hmm. Simonson Abbas, recently there was an occurrence that basically needs your breakdown as to the way it happened and as to the results that it got. And it was how the European Union was trying to push the IRGC, Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, to be listed as a terrorist organization. And they rounded up their MPs. They had a meeting about that. Of course, prior to that, lots of media hype about that. But it came down to the fact that Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian said, listen, if you're going to go ahead with this, then there might be some question marks and maybe a move by Iran in order to move away from being a member of the NPT. And then we noticed not immediately, but very soon after, how they backed down from that stance. Well, why do you think that happened? I mean, what was the reason? Because that's not something that Iran has, at least based on my memory and recollection, that it has said before. But then it showed what the reaction that came from the EU, basically backing away from it.
Well, I think the game is that the Western Atlantic Zionist Alliance basically wants to push Iran as far as they can. They don't want to push them too far, yet they are pushing their luck to the point where Iran is left with no choice. I mean, Iran has no real reason to abide by any of these international agreements and laws because it's up against an enemy, as we've just clarified, which has no regard for any of these rules and regulations. It had no regard for the rules and regulations when it assassinated Lieutenant General Soleimani and the extrajudicial killing of a diplomatic mission that was heading to Iraq. They didn't, no international institution followed up any kind of punishment for the Americans. The nuclear scientists that were regularly murdered by the Israelis, assassinated in Iran itself, I haven't seen any follow-up to that from the institutions that regard themselves as the paragons of justice and bringing nations to book. And so it goes on. This is a never-ending list where, Iran itself it doesn't really need to abide by any of these laws or any of these institutions because, first of all, most of these institutions get their funding from the U.S. I can name and therefore they're all
very well.
They all have an illegitimate.
Sorry to jump in. I want to give 1 minute to John Busnish under a minute. Sorry, Mohsen Abbas. John Busnish, even in U.S.'s national security assessment and report, it came out that Iran is not after developing nuclear weapons. And that has been stated time and again. But at the same time, we notice the politicization of Iran's nuclear file. Are they aware of the inconsistencies when it comes to Iran? And what is their ultimate game plan moving forward, or your projection down the line here? In less than a minute, please.
Yes. Well, they absolutely are aware and are designing all of their dispatches, all of their information as a propaganda war against Iran. There is no doubt in my mind that Iran is a military target of Israel and a military target of the United States because they simply want to control every country in the region. I suggest that you continue to abide by the agreements that you've signed and continue to develop your civil program, as you've said to the public, and to defend yourself in international institutions as best you can. And with God's help, you will survive and succeed.
Thank you, John Busnish, journalist and political analyst. Say Mohsen Abbas, thank you for your contribution. Journalist and political commentator from London. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mika Batahwe and the team, it's goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.